You're listening to RIB Connect Radio. It's the afternoon edition and time to look behind the medical headlines with Ask the Pharmacist, and our resident pharmacist Elizabeth Roddick joins us. Hello.
Hello, Simon.
From New Life Pharmacy. You've had your hair done, haven't you?
I have.
It looks very nice, by the way.
All right, thank you.
Goodness me, before I get into trouble, I'm not saying anything. Anyway, we've got some great stories for you to look at today, and we've been hearing about prebiotics to help sleep. Now, what are prebiotics?
Yeah, there was a BBC documentary, Simon, on sleep, and Dr. Mosley, the presenter, found that taking prebiotic fibre before bed helped improve the quality of his sleep. He's seemingly an insomniac, he told us on the programme. Prebiotics generally consist of dietary fibres and oligosaccharides. Now, they are carbohydrates containing a small number of simple sugars. The prebiotics provide food for good bacteria in the gut, so they're supposed to have a lot of health-promoting properties. Now, the research, Robert Thompson, a researcher, published his findings on prebiotics and sleep, and this is why it's quite exciting, the Journal of Frontiers in Behavioural Neuroscience. Prebiotics are naturally occurring in some foods, such as chicory, artichoke, raw garlic, leeks, onions. The researchers fed the three-week-old male rats a standard food, and against a food containing these prebiotics. They then looked at brain activity of the rats, and they found that the rats on the prebiotic diet spent more time in NREM sleep. Now, that's non-rapid eye movement sleep. And it's a part of sleep that's restful, and also along with good nutrition, NREM sleep can make a difference to brain development and function. The other benefit of a high prebiotic diet was it increased REM sleep. Now, that's the part of the sleep in the rapid eye movement, the dreaming side, which promotes recovery from stress, even reducing the incident of post-traumatic stress. So more studies are needed to prove the benefits of prebiotics in sleep, but I think it's certainly worth a try.
I had an artichoke last week.
Well, did you sleep well?
I can't remember. I should have been looking out for it if I'd have known. Now, they're not to be confused with probiotics, though, are they? They're completely different.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing, I think. These are live microorganisms that are purported to have health benefits. Large numbers of these microorganisms live in the body and in the intestine, for example, help digest food, destroy the bad bacteria. Disease-causing microorganisms, as well as producing vitamins. There's some evidence that probiotics stop diarrhoea caused by infections or antibiotics, and they can improve symptoms of irritable bowel disease. Now, what the research hasn't proved conclusively is which probiotics are good for particular conditions. That would have been useful. How much to take, for example, and who exactly could benefit. But I know I'm now keeping a range for people today and, you know, in my pharmacy.
Right. Well, do we know how they work then?
Again, there's some suggestions on how they work. For example, they could be stabilising the digestive tract, maybe helping the microorganisms in the gut to get back to normal after either an antibiotic or disease. And they may overtake the undesirable microorganisms and stimulate the immune response.
Are they safe?
I think if you yourself are healthy, then they're reasonably safe. Only lactobacillus and bifidobacterium have been studied, but there's lots of others on the market that we don't really know very much about. Long-term safety, we don't have the data, but I usually suggest a short course, for example, with an antibiotic or a trial for those. I do quite a lot of allergy screening, and I do suggest if somebody's got irritable bowel disease, I think it's worthwhile trying.
Righty-ho. Now, moving on, and I've mentioned this already, I'll try and get the big words right. A couple of bad nights are enough to make a person look significantly more ugly. And that'll be why you said, have I not slept all week? And you came in, isn't it? Yeah.
No, it's something about you mentioning my hair, so I decided to mention that. This was a Swedish study, Simon, using volunteer students, mainly in their early 20s, but the age range was 18 to 47. So the 25 students were photographed twice, once after they'd had sleep deprivation for 2 nights. That was just 4 hours sleep. And then again after 2 normal nights sleep, 8 hours. Now, 122 members of the general public were then asked to rate the photographs and ask, how much would you like to socialise with this person, or how attractive do you think he is, or how healthy they looked, how trustworthy? The results were that people were less willing to socialise with those who'd been sleep restricted. There was no difference in the trustworthy scores. Mm-hmm. The researchers suggested that restricting sleep could affect facial appearance negatively and decrease others' willingness to socialise with the person.
Explains a lot in my life.
But the study only showed a very small impact in putting people off, so it doesn't seem to be a huge problem. But of course, poor sleep itself can affect your health. It can be an increase in the risk of diabetes, heart disease, obesity. It can also be an increase in depression and anxiety. So to maximise sleep pattern, you need to have a regular number of hours sleep. The bedroom should be cool, maybe uncluttered. Exercise is important, but not too near bedtime. And coffee, heavy meals near bedtime can disrupt sleep. So have a relaxing bath. That was one of the things. And then cool down and listen to soothing music. That's one of the things you can do and have a comfortable night's sleep.
Because it's all to do with circadian rhythms, isn't it? And a lot of people who are living with sight loss do have to live with insomnia at various times, because it's a funny old thing, circadian rhythm, isn't it?
Yes, of course, that's, as you know, if you think about jet lag, that's where we get all upset, our bodies get all upset, and it's to do with light. And clearly, as you say, if you are blind, then presumably you don't have the same ability to be affected by that light, which, again, affects the brain through the eyes and will reset your clock at certain times to do with light, yeah.
Yeah, and the circadian rhythms, they're not a precise time either. They tend to move, and that's why you end up sometimes feeling sleepy at some times, and other times you sleep at the right time. So it's, yep. It can be a bit of an ongoing thing. Now, this was a headline that was a bit controversial, I thought, last week, and it's the idea that people can be fat but medically fit is a myth.
Yeah, these were University of Birmingham researchers who used electronic health records from 1995 to 2015. These were from the Health Improvement Network database, and that's from GP practices. They grouped people according to their BMI. Now, that's a body mass index. You work that out from your weight and your height. And they were checked as to whether they had any coronary heart disease, such as angina, heart attack, stroke, or something called TIA. That's like a mini stroke, and whether they had circulatory problems with pain and walking. And the results were that out of 3.5 million in the study, 21% were obese and 14% of them had no additional health risks. So they were called metabolically healthy. But those overweight people were 50% more likely to get heart disease, 7% more likely to get cerebrovascular disease, for example, a stroke, and twice as likely to get heart failure. So the bottom line is that in this study, there were certainly more risks of disease in those that were obese. But some of the detractors from this research were looking at, say, a rugby player, where the body mass index would naturally be high, yet could be said to be fat and fit. But most of the fat would be in muscle, which makes the BMI higher. Certainly, if you're not a fit person and you're overweight, then the risks of heart disease and stroke are definitely greater.
Yeah, and I suppose with rugby players as well, the thing is your heart is the same size, isn't it? So it's got to work this body. So, you know, it's putting a lot of strain on it, isn't it? It doesn't matter what way you look at it.
Yep, you're absolutely right, Simon.
Righty-ho, now we're moving to the knee now, aren't we? So it was a headline that keyhole knee surgery for arthritis pain is pointless.
Yeah, researchers were from a variety of institutions in Canada and Australia. Now, keyhole surgery is called arthroscopic surgery, and the guideline concerning this was being looked at to see if the procedure was worthwhile. Now, people with knee pain usually have osteoarthritis or meniscal tears. That's when you hear clicking sounds in your knee. Current practice is usually to wait before surgery using exercise, weight loss, and, of course, anti-inflammatory painkillers such as ibuprofen. They may also get a steroid injection. Now, 2 million procedures of keyhole surgery are performed worldwide, and it's a cost of $3 billion in the United States. So this is why they were looking at it. One trial that was performed last year showed that keyhole surgery was no better than exercise. The conclusion was that keyhole surgery in the knee doesn't, in fact, improve long-term pain or function. Certainly, some patients found some relief for a few months, but that wore off within a year. If you do have surgery that can result in pain, swelling, patients are unable to wait beer for some time. The expert panel review came to the conclusion that the only beneficial use for keyhole surgery was for someone with a truly locked knee, where they couldn't straighten the leg, and for tears of cartilage. I know that's a typical skiing injury. So it's really not recommended for use in people suffering from, say, osteoarthritis, which is almost like growing older, you get pains in your knees. So they're saying don't use it for that.
So what about if they don't use keyhole surgery, but they actually open the door? Right, selling us.
That was too much for me, Simon.
Just sorry about that. We've got one final story we'll have a look at, and I mentioned this earlier, and I'm quite interested in this because I do like fizzy water. Fizzy water could cause obesity by encouraging you to eat more. Now, I don't see, if anything, I would have thought it bloated you up.
Yeah, interesting. I was looking at the research. It was from Palestine. And it was animal research, certainly, and they were looking to see whether consuming fizzy drinks could contribute to putting on weight. We know that sugar, clearly, in drinks can cause obesity, but the researchers wanted to know whether CO2, carbon dioxide, made a difference. And it was an experiment with rats. We were given four different drinks: tap water, flat soda, regular carbonated soda, or diet carbonated soda. And they looked at their weight, blood sugar, cholesterol, and food intake was measured after 6 months. And they also checked something called ghrelin. Now, that's a hormone that's released when you're hungry. And when the rats died, the researchers examined how much of the hormone had been produced and also checked the liver for fatty deposits. To complete the study, they also looked at some healthy men. They were given a light breakfast, then an hour later given the same four drinks. Again, blood samples were taken. The researchers, again, were looking for this hormone ghrelin. The results were that the rats that drank tap water or flat soda weighed less than those that had the diet and the sugary fizzy drinks. So that's interesting. There was less weight gain in the rats that drank water. And when the fizzy drinks were introduced, the rats ate more food than water and flat soda. And again, increased levels of this hormone ghrelin. Now, the humans, they found they had higher levels of the hormone again after drinking fizzy drinks. And what we're saying is that makes you eat more. And after 1 hour after food, three times higher than after flat soda, or six times higher after water. This is this hormone again. So the research shows that when you drink fizzy drinks, that's the carbon dioxide, it causes you to eat more food, gain weight, cause fatty liver disease by increasing this ghrelin again. It was certainly a very small sample of humans, so we can't categorically say that this will be definitely something that will happen. Also, it might not just be this hormone. They didn't measure the hormone that stops us overeating. As you were saying, Simon, maybe when you get that bloating, this hormone kicks in that stops you overeating. Although the fizzy drinks link is not totally proved, it does suggest that plain water is definitely superior for your health.
Well, that's good, because I have moved on to that. I mean, I don't drink fizzy water very often, but I did go through a spell when I drank it a lot because I thought, well, I'd been drinking too much Coca-Cola.
And did you get the reverse effect? In fact, you didn't feel more hungry?
I can't remember.
You can't remember, right?
I never even crossed
my
mind.
Well, this is proving that you can actually eat too much with fizzy drinks.
I eat a lot less now than I did then. So I ate more then in those days. So, okay. You know, I'm a useless experiment, aren't I? If you've got any questions on anything we've been talking about this afternoon or anything else to do with medical things, then please do get in touch. Or you can get in touch with me here, or you can get in touch with Elizabeth at her pharmacy, which is
newlifepharmacy.co.uk.
So if you've got anything, do get in touch, or get in touch with Elizabeth, and Elizabeth will be back in a couple of weeks. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Always learn something new. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Simon.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio.